Hello, everyone, and welcome to a very special festive year-end edition, episode 80 of Dominaria Judgment, a weekly Constructed Magic podcast brought to you by me, Dom Harvey, along with Ari Lax. And today, once again, we're going over a wide range of topics. We're going to do this this recap of all of the major things of the year, whether it's sets, decks, tournaments, cards, what have you. But also, we are very much a Constructed Magic podcast this week, where we'll be touching on at least Modern, Pioneer, and Legacy all in some capacity for some reason.
Yeah. I mean, there was a tournament that did feature all of those, and do you know who won that one? I wasn't really paying too much attention to the coverage.
I did attend that tournament and participate in it, so I can give you a report directly from the trenches there. But first, I guess we can get our brief housekeeping announcements out of the way. So, as always, over the long holiday season, you can find us, as always, on Patreon at patreon.com/dominaria_judgment. You can find us on Twitter at dominaria_pod. And you can find us and many other holiday goers full of festive cheer over in the Discord as well. So with that, without any further ado, let's get into, I guess, the less exciting tournaments from this weekend.
Yeah, I mean, we had the Modern Challenges. They had some sort of interesting results. I think if we look at the trend of the last month, it's sort of been Rakdos versus Izzet at the top of the format. And this weekend, Izzet Murktide just sort of took it all back. And we're starting to see a metagame that looks a lot more like one where Izzet is, in fact, the best deck. For example, Yawgmoth had a very good weekend, likely because it was playing against Izzet and not Rakdos, because that Rakdos matchup, that's not a good one.
Demonic Tutors, as always, had a very good weekend, top-8ing both of the Modern Challenges, but also a second copy of the deck in second place on Sunday in the hands of Racerman. And that is, if you go back a month or two, that would not seem too out of line, but right now, when Yawgmoth had basically vanished off the face of the earth, to see that happen again is, I guess, somewhat reassuring for the Yawgmoth fans out there.
Yeah, I mean, the deck is still very powerful. It just, as always, has very polarized matchups, and those polarized matchups were very much not in its favor the last month. And whenever those matchups are in its favor, then things look a lot better.
And then, as you mentioned, a pretty big rebalancing away from Scam in favor of Murktide. And it's not like Murktide ever really left. I think you would struggle to find a prolonged stretch at really any point since the release of MH2 where we went for months on end without Murktide being the most popular deck or the most successful deck in some tournament or another. But I think it's more a case of, like, a lot of people just play Murktide. Like, that's how they like to play Modern, and often that's going to be a very good choice, and right now it might have circled back around officially to being just the best choice once again.
Yeah, I think some of this just has to do with, like, if Rakdos is the deck to beat, Murktide is the best deck to beat it with that is pretty good against the rest of the field. And also, like, the combined effect of Rakdos and Breach making a lot of the things that were directly aimed at Murktide as the Raghavan deck of choice kind of fall away. So it's just kind of like a really nice time where, like, people weren't really trying to beat up on Murktide. Also, even though we do see Rhinos in these top eights and a delightful appearance from Karuga, a lot less Leyline Binding than there previously had been. So the card Murktide Regent is back to an all-time high.
Yeah, that whole trio of Prismatic Ending, Solitude, Leyline Binding, really not a big feature of the format at present, and so you can exploit that however you wish. If you were someone who was determined to play Scam into a Murktide heavy field, what would you do? Is there anything you can do? Is that just structurally unfixable, do you think? Or are there more radical measures you can take if you're really determined to fix that matchup?
No, I think you can bring the matchup pretty close. It's not so bad that I wouldn't consider playing Rakdos, because Rakdos gets a lot of other equity against the metagame. It's basically like the question of, like, if it's less Rakdos is bad against Izzet and more like the times where Izzet is better than Rakdos involve a lot of spots where Dothi Voidwalker and Blood Moon aren't good. And if those cards aren't good, then why are you playing Rakdos in the first place? Like, the Izzet matchup is sort of a symptom of the problem.
If you go back to that phase, right, it was more generic Rakdos before a Scam had entered the common vernacular just yet. I know there was a debate in the Discord this week over how exactly do you conceptualize the Scam deck? Because someone was saying that they had this background in these black midrange decks, and they picked up Scam and just weren't able to really leverage that experience and felt more lost than they expected to. And to me, my immediate thought is, well, I don't know if it really is a midrange deck. You know, it's the kind of thing which would get classified as Rakdos midrange in the most generic sense on Goldfish or what have you. But in terms of the actual play patterns, I think it's a lot more complicated than that.
Yeah, it is a deck that kind of falls back into the mid-range plan if the game is not over by turn three. That's what makes it really powerful is... I'm trying to think of the right... It almost feels like for the first three turns of the game, you're playing something very similar to like Classic Affinity, where you have a number of different explosive draws that are really aggressive and problematic for people to handle. It's just that, like, once you exit that phase, your plan is, I don't know, like, cast a Fury from your hand for 5 mana and, like, feign death your creature because that's what that card does.
Yeah, you can do a decent impression of normal Rakdos midrange, and that is part of why the deck can succeed, is that the fail case is actually pretty decent a lot of the time. But that's not the game that you want to be playing, ideally. And we've seen just generic, no-name brand Rakdos midrange pop up here and there, but there's a reason that that hasn't really had that much sustained success, I think. Whereas the Scam deck is this weird, like, two-card Monty deck, or you have these one-card combos even, where sometimes, like, it's Blood Moon and 3 mana sources, or Dalthy Voidwalker and 2 mana sources, and then these various two-card combos stitch in with that, and then that is held together by this core of, yeah, sometimes you just play Ragavan into some removal and beat them up, and that's fine too.
Yeah, well, I guess on that note, you know, you mentioned there's not a lot of Rakdos showing up. There's been a decent amount of Jund Saga, and then also we should mention the fact that one of these two challenges was won by Temur Saga, which is just cards.
I think the official name for back in the day is just Temur Box.
Yeah, this is very, well. I don't know how many Temur players had Urza Saga in their box, but it's certainly in this deck.
Yeah, there are some interesting numbers. So just some quick hits. 2 Tarmogoyf, 2 Dragon's Race Channeler, 3 Fable of the Mirror Breaker, and then we have 3 Mana Leak, 1 Spell Snare, 1 Spell Pierce, 2 Lightning Bolt to go along with our Unholy Heats, 3 Urza Saga, 2 Presager Who Endures, and then a mana base that is, it seems like it just about has enough colored sources of your 3 different colors elsewhere, and then the usual sideboard of saga targets, and we got our Gigantha and a bunch of random stuff. But yeah, this is very much just team of cards, and if you told me that a deck like this was good, I think I probably would believe you. But if you also told me, okay, well, I've moved 5 different numbers around, and now we have, you know, 4 Tarmogoyf instead of 2, and we've cut the channelers entirely, and, you know, we're up to 4 mana leak or down to 2 mana leak, like, I couldn't tell you what is correct there. I would just kind of nod politely and smile, I think.
Yeah, I think the run afouls in the sideboard kind of tell the story of this deck for me, which is, like, I struggle to want to present this deck in a format with Murktide Regent Rising. I do want to shout out the fact that Mana Leak won both challenges. There was Mana Leak in this deck, and then the other challenge was won by, like, pretty classic creativity. Not the Persist build, just, like, not even Leyline Bindings, just, you know, Temur, 2 Temur decks with Mana Leak, I guess. You could call the creativity deck that, sort of, I guess.
In the loosest possible sense, yes. Maybe creativity also is a Temur box deck of sorts.
Yeah, each of these decks takes one card not really in the Temur box and puts it in, but the other cards in the creativity deck are very much Temur box cards.
Yeah, maybe this is just validation for the idea that you can take the good, cheap red cards and add some Urza Saga in, and that core is powerful enough to subsidize whatever other nonsense you decide to fill out this last 10 or 15 slots with.
Yeah, I think some of this is also just, like, leaning into how good Fable is with Saga, in the sense of, like, anything that makes stray treasure tokens is pretty powerful there.
Yeah, I do love the idea of pairing Render 6 with both Fable and Ledger Shredder, just having ways to convert those excess resources, which do have severe diminishing returns past a certain point, into actual relevant cards, potentially. And also, this is the fabled Render 6 Urza Saga deck, even though, in practice, I think that combination has underwhelmed compared to what I expected at the time.
Yeah, again, looping back to something else you mentioned, I'm also skeptical that the 18 colored sources in this deck are casting your Renin 6 pretty fast. I said 17, but I caught myself and then included the Springleaf Drum.
Yeah, although you kind of also need other colored mana sources for that one to become a colored mana source in its own right. So, some fraction of one, but we'll go with it.
Okay, continuing down the Temur theme, is Footfalls another Temur box deck?
I'm going to give it the privilege of its own distinct identity at this point, I would say.
Okay, that's fair. I just wanted to shout out the fact that the 7th place Footfalls deck from one of these challenges had Orvar and Casali Ambusher in the sideboard, just for the maximum amount of surprises.
Hell yeah. It's, sadly, you don't get to pull those in at the same time, but here's hoping you can find a justification at some point.
Yeah, I'm playing a bit with the Elementals deck right now, and I could see a situation where Orvar comes in just to, like, clone all your stuff with Ephemerate, but, like, that would also involve putting Casali Ambusher in that deck, and that's not happening.
Is it not? I thought when you you began on that digression, I thought, okay, actually, this is a deck which is a little bit clunky, maybe has issues with Ragavan on the draw. I could see Casali Ambusher actually being the solution to what ails you there.
You know, as you say it, like, there are Voice of Resurgences in the deck as it stands, and they basically have the attributes of, like, white, green, and elemental, and Ambusher has two of those three characteristics.
Also, it's a cat, so you can still play Kahira.
That is not something I had considered. Wow, that is astonishing. I'm glad that it fits the theme.
Yeah, you can ambush the Ragavan, and then 5 turns down the line, when you finally cast your Kahira, you can even pump your Ambusher and get to work.
Kahira's messed up, yo. Vigilance is a hell of an ability.
It's not the best companion, but being the 5th or 6th best companion is still a pretty good place to be.
Well, you're saying it's not the best companion, but, like, name the other 7 legal companions in Modern. It may just be the best one.
Yeah, as much as I want Gairuda to be good, I can't say that with a straight face. And then Karuga's, you know, maybe that's just Respect the Cat rather than Karuga, but that one's making some waves. The occasional Oboshek pops up. I know you've been in the leagues with those recently, but yeah, I think it is kind of a, we should not sell Giganthosaur, but Kahira, yeah, maybe it is actually the best one left at this point.
I don't know. I remain a Gigantha skeptic forever. That card, I don't know. It feels like paying 3 to put that card into your hand is conceding most games. It's a game action. Like, you're allowed to take this action at any time, but, like, only on your turn.
I know there was another round of companion discourse recently sparked by Mark Rosewater's, is it biannual or biennial? Never sure which one of it is, but either way, one of his occasional Stormscale articles where he looks over the mechanics from those recent sets and grades the mechanics on a few different metrics in terms of their likelihood of coming back for various reasons. And Companion was brought up as, I think, a 9 out of 10, where maybe if we wanted to be adventurous and the situation was right, we could go back to this again, but there were just these severe inbuilt issues with the entire mechanic. And then I think what actually sparked the discourse part of this, and not just the ranting and raving on Twitter part of this, was Patrick Sullivan had a response basically calling out the, or almost the displacing of blame there to the issues inherent in the mechanic, as opposed to just the development balancing of it being so far wide of the mark that it speaks to larger issues in that process instead.
No, it is the mechanic. The mechanic of starting with an 8th card is the problem. I don't want to, like... I think you can put 100% of the blame on the mechanic and then another 50% on the blame of, like, on anyone who developed it. Like, there is room for more than 100% of blame here.
Yeah, so this is one of those rare times where we just get to crack open the 100% barrier and blame as many people as we want. I think, honestly, yeah, it is both. It is the fact that whenever something like this has been tried, outside of Magic, right? Like, this is a recurring balance issue in Hearthstone. Like, all of these various digital games, which, in their attempt to distinguish themselves from each other, they try to, like, actually make this mechanic work, and I don't think any of them have really managed to do it, by my understanding. And then there is just, yeah, the actual batch of companions that we did get. How does Original Lurrus get its way out the door? I just don't... That will always be an absolute mystery, and, like, a... Lurrus is really the exclamation mark on that whole kind of dark age for Magic design.
Yeah, I have nothing to say about that, but I will say that Spellslingers, the recent digital game from Wizards, is the only game I've ever seen do the companion-esque mechanic correct. And that is very specifically because I don't really want to get too far into it because there's, like, a lot of further discourse on it, but, like, the problem in Hearthstone and WoW TCG was often that the cards were either too prescriptive or not prescriptive enough, and, like, your deck was too defined by your restriction of companion. And that game does, like, splashing very well effectively. And also the companion mechanics are not scripted to, like, an additional value. It's like a build around mechanic that you actually build a deck around, that it can be flexible or as inflexible as you want. I really don't think the companions in Magic, like, the entire mechanic is literally just, here's an extra piece of cardboard, how good can it be? You can't go back and retroactively make that style of thing work.
Yeah, I think the kind of toy example that Patrick used was, well, yeah, if you have 25 swamps in your deck, then you just get to play a Sengu Vampire or something. Something which is really optimizing for flavor and resonance over actual competitive viability. Maybe the lesson of the mechanic is, even what seems like a very incidental eighth card is, it's still an eighth card and it's still pretty good in that context. But it seems like you can construct a range of those examples where, in a very limited way, maybe the mechanic works in its own little sandbox there and doesn't reach escape velocity.
Yeah, it's a really tight window. You should not be making your specific, this game like should not be trying to shoehorn it in after 30 years. It's just not how it works.
Yeah, I think one issue too is that for the essence of companion to really work, you need multiples of them to be showing up. But if it's, you know, you have a modern tournament with 100 players and five of them have a companion and it's only one companion that's viable, I think that's a pretty big failure from the mechanic. Whereas what you want to happen is there are three or four different companions showing up across a wide range of decks, and that in itself tells you something about the decks in question and maybe the players in question as well. And so if you go back to the original cycle, yeah, I think your Obosh in even its original form, but certainly its current form, that's pretty cool. And like, there are real sacrifices going into to make an Obosh deck. And when your opponent reveals an Obosh, it's like, okay, well, the terms of engagement have kind of changed, but we're still basically playing a similar game. But you need that cycle to be mostly Oboshes and not mostly like Yorion, Karuga, somewhere in there for the thing to work, and that definitely did not happen the first time around.
Yeah, I even struggled to include the original Obosh in that category, because usually that card was just like, if you control a permanent, win the game. That was not especially fun. The existing Obosh is pretty nice, though.
Yeah, let's move away from companion discourse for the time being, although I'm sure we will have calls to revisit it at some point in the future. Anything else from the challenges this weekend before we get on to the main event, if I can call it that?
Quick shout out to Coert in 10th place of one of these challenges, a player who's been on the innovative front of Modern for a while, one of the first players to pick up the Heliod deck back in 2020. Mm-hmm. But they are playing Tron with main deck Cityscape Leveler, and I think that is an adaptation that is just, like, really smart. I know Aspiring Spike, after this came out, tweeted about, like, just play four of this card, and that makes a lot of sense. It's just, you know, you have hit Tron, this card, like, a lot of the problems with Tron right now are that you can hit Tron and then lose the game. It's very hard to lose the game when the card you cast off Tron vindicates their permanent as you cast it, and then flashes back to vindicate something else.
Yeah, I think one issue with Tron these days is, what are you meant to do with the mana? Because Wurmcall Engine in the past has been almost the perfect threat for a bunch of different matchups, and that's not so much the case anymore. And then Karn Liberated also is not what it used to be. And so, yeah, if you have turn 3 Karn on the play, that's all going to win the vast majority of your games. But anything slower than that, or even turn 3 Karn on the draw, sometimes just seems unimpressive by comparison. And so Leveler is a really nice addition, certainly in this list where you have Sanctum of Rugin, so it both triggers Sanctum and can be found with Sanctum, and it is meaningfully cheaper than Ulamog in that role a lot of the time. But also with how popular Murktide is in particular, having another threat at that kind of a turn 4, 8 mana mark once you have Tron that leaves you something relevant behind through Counterspell, I think is a really big deal. And it's not just one thing behind, right? You don't just kill that one threat. It's coming back for more next turn. And so, yeah, if you get to eat a Counterspell and their threat with a Leveler, and then the Unearth is clocking them for 8, hitting their other threat in the process, well, whatever you have left at that point should be able to clean up the mess.
Yeah. I think the part of this is that, like, a lot of similar threats you can just, like, cast, and if they don't Counterspell it, they don't, like, immediately lose the game. No, they lose on the spot to this card. It doesn't give them any window. Like, there's no good outcome here.
Yeah, I do also want to shout out the three copies, actually, of Haywire Might in the sideboard, too. So the first one makes a lot of sense as a Karn the Great Creator target, a big boon for that card when it shows up. But also in Tron in particular, where you want to have some additional answers to cards like Blood Moon and so forth, and then Hammer historically has been a very difficult matchup. Haywire Might has those applications, but it is also just a colorless way of doing that for the first time that you can find off Ancient Stirrings and cast with your, you know, whatever your Tron land is, while also being like a decent blocker and so on against aggro, just as a cherry on top there.
Yeah, Haywire might just having a generally good weekend. I believe both the decks in the finals of the Temur Saga weekend, where it was Temur Saga versus Bant Hammer, which basically means that both decks had Haywire Might, and I guess the Temur deck had some green spells, but I don't think the Bant deck, like, Hammer just had Haywire Might, right? Like, there's not a green spell here besides activating that card.
Yeah, it's as small of a green commitment as you can have while still being called a Bant deck.
Yeah, the Windswept East might be like 60% of it.
Mm-hmm. So with that, let's get on to the Mana Traders Invitational, their end of year event from this past weekend. So this is the culmination of all of the monthly events across the year, and so the top two from each of those get invited to this, and then the cumulative top finishers who have shown that consistency over the course of the year get invited too, and then the monthly leaderboard race plays into that as well. So lots of different avenues to get there. In the end, 48 players facing off in Modern, Pioneer, and Legacy, and the winner in the end was a good friend of the show. It's me!
Yeah, you win again.
You'd love to see it. So I guess it's tough to know where to start when you win the tournament. So what do you think is a good place there?
Okay, so let's save any Legacy talk for later, because it sounds like you did not want to interact with that format in any capacity more than you were legally obligated to. And I think that brings us to a later discussion.
Well, let's touch on that now in that case, because this speaks to both an issue for the players and the designers of the tournament, where it's really hard to structure a tournament like this in a way that does justice to each of the formats at the same time. But it felt like an effort wasn't really made with Legacy in this case. So the structure of the tournament is you play 9 rounds on day one, three of Legacy, three of Modern, three of Pioneer, and then day two, after this 6-3 cut, is a double elimination bracket where you play Modern until you lose, and then the loser's bracket is Pioneer. And so Legacy is, you know, you play your Legacy deck for the first three rounds of the tournament, and then you can return it to your rental service, which is probably Mana Traders, because you're not going to need it again. And so Legacy really felt like an afterthought for this tournament, and even if you were a total blank slate coming into this, if you qualified via Pauper or something, and now you have three new formats to prepare for, it really made no sense whatsoever to devote any attention to Legacy. You should just pick a stock deck, which you think is somewhat easy to play, lock it in, and then turn your attention to the other two formats. And so what that meant was the decks in that space, like the Stompy decks, so the new Initiative deck in particular, that was a very popular default choice for the tournament, because not only is it maybe one of the two best decks in the format, but it is also, if you're not like a constant Legacy grinder, it's a deck that you can pick up and play at a reasonably high clip without actually putting any hard work into that.
Yeah. I think you said the words that it is literally one of the worst formats that you have played right now.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think Legacy across the years has always had the problem of, as formats age, then the design mistakes across the years pile up to the point where the format just becomes defined by those, and you need to have that, like, Mr. Burns illnesses in the door dynamic of all of them keeping each other in this weirdly uneasy balance. And Legacy has been that at various points in its past. I think at this point, though, like, you're really seeing the rough edges coming through. And so, like, the Delver just being this dominant deck yet again in its fifth or sixth iteration in a row, like, that has grown old already. And then the new kid on the block in the Initiative deck, well, it's a play pattern that we've mostly seen before in the form of the other Ancient Tomb Stompy decks. And I don't think the play patterns there are especially inspiring for the most part. And just the Initiative as a concept we have gone on about recently, so don't really have anything more to add there. But then outside of that dynamic, you know, I mentioned last week that a lot of the more mainstream anti-Delver decks are really fundamentally weak against the Initiative, and so that helps to kind of narrow the format, if anything, even though this new deck is being added. But if you want to cast your eyes wider, what you're seeing is just this hellscape of combo decks. So if you wanted to test Legacy for this tournament, despite my warnings there, then you can't really do that in the Legacy leagues, because if you try playing those on Magic Online, you will just get like turn one by Oops or Reanimator or some like wacky Storm deck, or like the kind of decks which people love to speedrun a league with in an hour, you'll just hit a wall of those, and actually facing Delver, facing Initiative, like it might be easier said than done. And that is kind of the rest of the format. So yeah, if you are someone who you don't fancy playing Initiative, but you don't feel like you have the experience to play Delver, well, yeah, you're going to turn to Reanimator, or probably not Doomsday if you're a Legacy novice, but that's another egregious offender as well. It just feels like the whole format is either you're in one of these two poles, which I don't think either one of them adds too much at this point, or you're just, you know, hoping to untap with a permanent or a card in hand on your second turn and get to keep playing Magic from there.
Okay, let's forget about that format for now, forever, as long as we want. I want to talk about your Pioneer deck, because you've kind of been on this enchantment nonsense for a while. I think, let's just start with the upfront way of just saying, explain yourself.
The deck is cool as hell, so that is the main thing. Like, when I played it at the RC, it was much more of a heart choice versus a head choice. And for this tournament, it was a good default. Like, I had a list that I liked and, you know, was comfortable playing it and so on. And I thought it could conceivably be a good choice in a format full of Rakdos, which it turned out is what the tournament was, especially as it progressed into the later stages. How much of that was Rakdos actually doing well in the Pioneer portion versus the kind of broad spread of results in a mixed event? That's always hard to unpack, especially if you don't have that data there in front of you. But yeah, as the tournament went on, there was a lot of Black-Red and a lot of Phoenixes as well in that loser's bracket for Pioneer on day two. So even once I suffered that unfortunate loss in Modern early, I didn't actually hate my chances all that much of just maybe not running the table, which is what I had to do, but at least, you know, getting a few wins in there and keeping it interesting.
Yeah, well, I just want to ask about one specific card, and that's the Xur. Because when I played the deck, I had no idea what it was doing at any point in time.
Okay, yeah, this was the card which I cut from the list I saw, which were like 4-5 color with a bunch of Trilab ambitions and so on. And it felt like Xur was emblematic of the kind of nonsense that those decks were aiming for, where it's like, yeah, you're just playing this card because it has the word enchantment on it, aren't you? And it could conceivably do some cool things. When I tried it, though, it actually, it was shockingly impressive. Like, what you really need sometimes is a threat that you can get on 3 mana, because most of the rest of your toolbox at that spot on the curve, it's Knight of Vordom, it's Skyclave Apparition, it's these kind of utility Necrotiles of various sorts, and then you have your Moonburst Cleric, you have your Archon of Emira, and so on. But sometimes you want something that is just, like, good on the board, or gives you an immediate clock, and Xur with Incarnation alone, you turn the Incarnation into this 4-4 Death Touch, Lifelink, Hexproof. Like, that's a pretty substantial threat in its own right. And then add in anything like, you know, Leyline Binding is, of course, the big one, you know, costing 6, so it becomes a 6-6. But even just, like, your Fable of the Mirrorbreaker or something, or your Bitter Reunion, like, it actually just deserve summoning this weird motley crew of enchantments by itself is something which really does flip games in your favor. Also very good with Fires of Invention, which, like, every card is basically good with Fires of Invention, and that shouldn't be a selling point by itself, but it does come up more than you think, and when it does, like, it is very impressive.
Yeah, that's totally fair, I guess. There's also the use case of, like, you have 6 mana, you find a Xur, and now your Incarnation is protected from an interaction spell.
I had not actually even considered that. I don't think it's come up yet, but that is also a good selling point as well. Yeah.
Okay, well, never mind then. yeah. So, anything else you want to talk about in Pioneer? Because I guess it sort of looks like there's not a lot of mono green at this tournament, and that is generally the direction that the format is going, and that feels like it has a lot of second order impacts.
Yeah, mono green really has fallen off at this point, and so I think it's a little more justifiable to play decks like this, which are trying to go over the top of Rakdos, and maybe also a Phoenix too in their own way, but which can't really do that in a way that isn't just the worst version of mono green in that kind of heads up mirror. And Lotus Field is filling some of that void, and a lot of the decks which are in that space do also get clobbered by Lotus Field, which I did have to beat twice in elimination matches en route to this result here. And that's where, like, after a long and grueling day one, which was pretty frustrating a lot of the time, like, I refreshed the page for the last round, like the winning in round in Pioneer, and I see, okay, it's one of the main Lotus Field grinders on Magic Online. It's like, well, okay, it's over, right? There it is. Somehow sneak out a win there, and then day two, you know, going on this run in the loser's bracket and refresh the page again, and it's Lotus Field once again. Only three copies in the tournament, and I run into the second one, and I thought, okay, well, I've had a good run, you know, kept it interesting, but this is probably where it ends, and managed to beat them again as well. So I think the fail rate of Lotus Field, combined with the fact that, you know, game one with Archon and Redain, and it's actually not that implausible to win game one, and then you just need to steal one of the postable games. Like, it's not a good matchup. It might even be your worst matchup, but it's not catastrophically unwinnable the way that it has felt sometimes in the past. And, you know, knowing there were a few good Lotus Field pilots in the tournament, I added an Alpine Moon to the sideboard. I had both Mystical Dispute and Disdainful Stroke, and I'd moved the Redain to the main deck for other reasons as well. But the fact that it also helped against Lotus Field was a nice upside there too.
Yeah, that all checks out. The Archon thing is pretty clutch, and I guess we can bridge that into a discussion of... I brought up the mono-green thing because I played with the Tulio Jowdy collection of cards I own that are creatures instead of enchantments. I will say that is, like, one of the most disrespectful decks I have played in a long time. Just, like, your opponent loses to just the worst creatures of all time because one of the cards that you put in your deck beats them. Like, I do mean literally one, because you put one in there and don't really have a great way to find it. It just sort of happens. It's like, yeah, I would have put two in there if I thought it was better, but I guess, you know, maybe it's good against your deck. I don't know. It's just raw disrespect. But the mono green matchup for that deck was, did not seem good, but everything else felt like you could grind through it. I was wondering if, like, that sort of shift in the metagame meant there was a room for Pioneer to look a lot less like there are three big decks and a lot more like there are 10 years worth of cards.
Yeah, that was the concept that the 60 card version, not the 80 card version, that I did actually want to explore ahead of the RC and ended up playing against at the RC, which was essentially a green-white company with a bunch of the hate bears or hate creatures like Archon, Redain, and so on, instead of the more kind of tribal or aggressive themes. Because what I'd found in my Angels testing was, in a lot of matchups, you still kind of have to keep the Angels there and want to keep the Angels there, but you would board in a bunch of Archons and Redains over here, or like extra Brutal Cathars and Apparitions over here, and those would be the cards that you actively wanted to hit off your companies and reconstructions. And so part of me wondered, well, can we just rebuild this deck in such a way that that is the main goal now, of I have maybe eight elves, some Lovestruck Beasts or something, and then beyond that is Archons, Redains, like all of these very hateful permanents, and ways to find those consistently. And I was not able to kind of reify that concept ahead of the RC, but the list that I played against there did actually look pretty promising, and Tulio Jowdy, of course, just taking that and warping it to a whole new level.
Yeah, I think I underestimated the double up of Company and Kayla's Reconstruction, and just how powerful it is to have both of those cards at once, as well as, like, maybe overestimating the fail case of Kayla's Reconstruction, where, like, you pay six and you just don't get three things, versus just, like, I don't know, the way those decks play out where, like, you hit six mana sometimes, and then you tap six mana, and then it doesn't really matter whether you hit two or three things. It's just really nice if you do hit three.
I don't know, at least in the short term, how much attention there will be on Pioneer. I think this, you know, speculating about future steps in organized play a bit, I think this is kind of why the third regional championship is also going to be Pioneer, where maybe Modern seemed like a more natural choice, is that after creating this initial interest and momentum in the format again for the first cycle, you don't want that to dissipate to the point where people feel like that investment was wasted, or why did I even bother with that, and to not only experience that in the moment, but to kind of lose that trust in the system going long, and knowing that, you know, this work and that investment that you put in now might also pay dividends in 8 months from now, I think it's going to play a pretty big role in keeping that moving.
Yeah, I agree with that, and that acts as a pretty nice bridge to our main topic of sort of reviewing the year. I just have one final question, and I'm sure everyone at home is asking it. What the hell is Kura the Boundless Sky?
So it's a dragon, which green doesn't get a lot of dragons, doesn't get a lot of flyers. So I think this might actually be, I guess Dragon's Talk here has some weird stuff going on, but for the most part, you know, it's Kura and Jugan against the world. And Kura actually, so there's this kind of running meme with the online Amulet players of, well, in the grindy matchups, you kind of want to transform into a deck that has these, that has more threats and some of these, like, cheaper and more diverse threats. So you hedge against, like, Necromancer effects, and you just grind through removal a little bit better. And instead of trying to be this combo deck, you just present as many threats in a row as possible until one of them sticks and gets its job done. And so the question then becomes, what should those threats be? And that can really be anything you want it to be. And I've seen some truly off-the-wall options thrown in there. Elder Gargaroth, that kind of makes sense. But we can go deeper. And so, you know, you do the Scryfall search for all of the rare or mythic green 5-drops in Modern and see where that takes you. And where it took, I think Mistaken N was the player I first saw playing this, was Kura. And seeing that in action and thinking about it, it kind of made sense to me, because one issue you have against like Murktide in particular is often, okay, you've done the thing. You've found some secondary, tertiary threat that you find a window to sneak in, and it just gets embarrassed by some 8/8 Murktide Regent. Kura is the rare card that actually like stabilizes and offers to trade up in a favorable way against that. And then, like, if they kill it, you either get another pretty big threat, or you get like, okay, here's Cavern of Souls, Besage for your Blood Moon, and, you know, Talaria West to get the next threat. And like that form of surgical selection is really nice as well. So yeah, there are several spots which I think the VODs are up. You can go back and watch this on camera, where, you know, there's a window where I would not be able to resolve a Primeval Titan, or I have one in hand and can't cast it, but the shields are down, and I just, you know, summon this back for Kura and cast it, and now they can't make any inroads on the board, and I have all the time in the world to get the next threat in line queued up to get the job done. So I was skeptical. I don't know how many of these you can afford to play, but I think the first one actually does have a lot of very kind of narrow but specific utility there.
Got it. Tutor target, grindy matchups, and yep. Okay.
You see, the deck is quite dichotomous, but on the one hand, you want to race in the speedy matchups, but then you also want to grind in the grindy matchups. And so that's a tough circle to square, but I managed to do it. I have solved the modern format here.
Okay. Perfectly solved. There's nothing that will ever stop Amulet Titan. It only has good matchups.
No bad matchups, I think, is the common phrasing there. Yeah.
I did not want to say that. I wanted you to say it. So therefore, we can move along and talk about a year for Magic that feels like it was simultaneously like less tumultuous than the previous one, but also a lot of weird things that are still creating a lot of discourse as we speak right now.
Yeah, so there's a lot of ways to jump into this. We can go via the sets, the cards, the tournaments, or just wider topics as a whole. What do you think is a nice entry point here?
I mean, let's just start with trying to discuss what actually happened over the year. Like, in terms of set release, there was Neon Dynasty, Streets of New Capena, Dominaria United, The Brothers War, and then other sets. Just like, do you think you could name half of them if you just wanted to list the sets that came out this year?
Oh, God. No, I would like to say yes. And like, I know that being as capital O online as I am, and being so plugged into the constant Magic news cycle, I know that I have seen all of the sets from the year, I think, at least. But as of right now, yeah, I don't think I could get above that 50% waterline.
Yeah, I think this might be, you know, you're talking about the Legacy problem. I think this might just be one of the other problems where, like, if you want to play Legacy, you also have to look at an extra 1,000 cards a year, as well as no, you know, 10,000 previous cards that just don't exist otherwise. It is a lot of overhead for a format that is, I don't know. I don't know what the purpose is if it's just getting flooded with new product every single set that isn't really a set.
Yeah, I think this is part of what people are alluding to when they talk about like spoiler fatigue, and it feels like it's a chore and a job almost to kind of keep up with all of these set releases. Because if you're someone who just plays Pioneer, let's say, well, yeah, you have about as many sets as you had last year or 5 years ago or 10 years before. You know, you have, I think, the four mainstream set releases and you're good to go. If you're a modern main, then I think this year it was exactly the same amount, right? We didn't have any kind of supplemental set there, although Lord of the Rings coming 2023, so get that one on your calendar. But yeah, if you are someone who just plays Legacy, then you're in this weird spot of a lot of Legacy players only play that format, and they maybe have a lot of other commitments on their time and so on. It tends to attract an older crowd. Maybe you only get to play it a handful of times a month or a year, and so you are probably less dialed in to the overall like Magic Twitter timeline, and you want to be less dialed in, but at the same time, you have a greater obligation to follow what's going on, because at any given moment, you know, some something could just back up to your format and get dumped upon it, right? Like the initiative or Minsk and Boo or attractions and here's Comet, like the other like weird Unfinity Planeswalk. And there's just so much stuff to keep track of, and you weren't asking for this, and it's not clear who else was asking for it, and yet it's being kind of inflicted upon you regardless. And so for as much as the legacy community brings it upon themselves sometimes, and I think often doesn't do themselves any favors, I think in this case you do have a valid complaint, or at least the kernel of one.
I just learned that Displacer Kitten is from the same set as White Plume Adventurer, and I did not. I clearly have no idea of any cards that were not Modern legal that came out this year. Like, I don't know what happened. I'm just going to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, one of those cards was on Magic Online, basically from its inception, and one of them took actual months to get there, and as soon as it did, it all hell broke loose. And so, yeah, easy to mess up that timeline and just think, well, there were 25 sets released this year. Of course, they were in different ones. And yeah, and that's just like, if you are someone who just keeps it relatively mainstream, then you can avoid most of this. But if you're someone who, if you want to be a competitive Magic player, then you're dipping your toe in Arena and suddenly you have the Alchemy. Let's not even get started on Alchemy and that whole experiment from this year. But you have that, you have like Historic, I don't know where that's at nowadays. There's all of the stuff that is exclusive to that platform. And then, you know, you have, if you are involved in like the EDH community in any way, then there's all of that to keep track of. So it feels like that philosophy of, you know, not everything is for you, you can't hope to keep up with a thing, and you shouldn't try to, that really has manifested in just the cadence and the contents of the set releases this year in a way that I think is truly unprecedented.
Yeah, and I think there has been an announcement about altering the amount of product being put out next year, potentially in reaction to what has been seen there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that announcement in itself was a little ambiguous. It wasn't clear, A, what problem they thought that they were addressing, and B, if their announcement was actually going to address that. But maybe some signs of optimism there, something to cling to.
It's a classic WotC announcement of an announcement, right? Like, we are going to announce future products in a way that is consistent with this current announcement.
They reprinted announcing announcements. This is their like a time file remastered version of announcement formulas.
Yeah, so I guess let's talk about the actual sets that came out. I kind of want to start in the middle with Streets of New Capenna, because I think Streets of New Capenna is related to this issue of like no one really knowing what card, like just being a mess of cards, because that set was kind of like, I don't really know what was supposed to be happening with it.
Yeah, I think that set is the big busted flush of the year in terms of the mainstream releases. And I think a few different things go into that. So firstly, it is a gold set, and specifically a three-color set, which had high expectations coming in because we've had, it's been all wedges all the time recently, and this is our first time to revisit the shard combinations in, you know, going on 14, 15 years now. And so I think there were high expectations placed upon it, which when it, I think it's safe to say, failed to deliver upon those. Obviously, there was a lot of disappointment in that regard. I think also just the danger with gold sets is unless you have these clearly defined identities between your families or factions or however you're breaking it up, it's very easy for the colors and the card to just kind of blend together into one big kaleidoscopic mess. And I think Streets did a pretty good job, given what it had to work with in terms of carving out different niches in terms of like the lore and everything for these different groups and so on. But with only one set to do that, I think there's only so much work you can do. And this maybe speaks to just an inherent issue with the block cycle, or I guess it is just a set cycle these days for the most part, which is you have this one moment to both define yourself and to go through that whole like three-part story structure or what have you, and incorporate everything you want. And there's just so much to pack into every set that it's easy for stuff to get lost in the shuffle. And I think actually Neon Dynasty, which I think we'll come back to in a second as maybe the big success story of the year, suffered from some of that same problem too, where there was so much that of both original Kamigawa that you wanted to call back to and new stuff that you wanted to reinvent and introduce, that some of that just felt a little shallow in the end. And I could have used maybe Neon Dynasty Part 2 to explore some of that further. But yeah, I think structurally, Streets of New Capenna had a tough task ahead of it, and it just really failed to execute on the promise of that set in a big way.
Yeah, well, okay, so let's briefly touch on Kamigawa, because I actually want to highlight something specific where Streets is the only set this year that is not building on existing IP, right? You have Dominaria United and Kamigawa and Brothers War, which are all, like, Brothers War is literally just, like, we have released this set, we're just releasing a new set that is the set.
Yeah, and that latter half, it's not building on original IP, it's building on the original IP. This is, you're going back to the true foundations of Magic in a way that is, I think, quite safe, ultimately, and Dominaria United in particular, that, I think the set was, it was good for the most part, but it felt like it wasn't pushing boundaries, really, whereas Streets had to invent itself from scratch and try and pull that off, and that is a much higher bar to clear than just yet another, like, invasion callback remaster set, which is what I think Dominaria United was in the end. And then Streets, just, I think my closing thought on it is, it is telling that, you know, if you name the most iconic card from that set, it's the Triumphs, which is completing an existing cycle, and everyone expected that was only a matter of time. It's Ledger Shredder, it's, I guess, Unlicensed Hearse would be the next one on the list after that. You have to go pretty far down that list of cards to find, like, an actual three-color gold card. And we said that as, you know, in our initial preview episodes for the set, that this is their chance to really break up the stranglehold of the Omnath colors over Modern, because if you have these three-color cards that maybe tug you in a certain direction, those are deck body incentives which can't just be easily assimilated into the best deck with the best mana that can cast anything. And yet, you know, there's no... I guess, what would even be the most iconic tri-color card from the set? Like, Rafine, maybe? Or just some kind of interchangeable removal spell beyond that?
I could not name one if you asked me. And I think that this also relates to another issue of the set, which is, like, if you're going to make a tri-color city set when your prominent multicolor plane is a two-color city set, it would be really good if you made it feel distinct in a significant way. But, like, you could take half of the set and just, like, scribble out the name and just, like, write a Ravnica word on it, and it would just be fine.
Yeah, I mean, they set themselves a really tough task with that, too, because not only do you have one set to do it, but it's a crime-themed plane, and the color pie is pretty imbalanced in terms of how it leans into that. So, yeah, if you're some combination of, like, blue X, black X, what have you, okay, that lends itself naturally to that. Red X, even, like, in actual Ravnica, you had Rakdos as, like, the chaotic, like, circus, you know, tribe or whatever. Whereas if it's, okay, this is the banned crime family, what are you meant to do with that? Exactly. Like, it's a pretty hard question to answer. And then, yeah, I think it's when you're dealing with three color combinations instead of two, you know, Celestia feels very different from Dimir, just by default, by design. Whereas, you know, this combination of three colors over here and this other one over here, like, it's tough for each of the colors to really make itself heard in a distinct way within those pairings. And so, yeah, I think everything was kind of set up for the set to fail, and it would have to be a pretty impressive effort to overcome that, and it didn't feel like it was an impressive effort when all was said and done.
Yeah, well, also, they tried to make the three-color pairs, like, they focused on the overlap between them, which just ended up making the set feel like a two-color allied set. Yeah, just bad things happened.
Yeah, let's jump back to Neon Dynasty then, because there was a lot of expectation and hype coming into this set. You know, Mark Rosewater has been fending off Blogger-style comments for years over, when are we going back to Kamigawa? Usually with the response that, well, this is the set that polls the worst in all of our, you know, market research and so on. And so if we're going to do this, you have to make yourself heard and also calibrate your expectations fairly and, like, make sure that you're not setting us and yourself up for failure here. And in the end, I think this set was a smash hit. I think you hear some, like, minor criticisms here and there, but in the big picture, this is one of the most well-received and most enthusiastically received sets I can remember in years.
Yeah, I wonder if this set has resulted in more or less comments about when do we go back to Kamigawa, because it was so well-received. I think this set was, like, largely just phenomenal. I do sort of want to blame it for making... This is the one thing I'll say against it, which is that this is the set that made me just dislike sagas. I think that sagas, as they are designed in this set, are, like, emblematic of one of the core problems with current design. And I think if you play the Arena Cube, you see a bit of that right now, where the problem is that There is no clear delineation between like creatures that are supposed to like cost mana and advance your board presence and Mull Drifters. Like everything is just a Mull Drifter at efficiency, so like there's no point in getting under anybody because you'll just start trading with Mull Drifters. But like also if you don't take some legal game action, you might actually lose the game. So like it, I think that the saga part of the set, with the fact that they are effectively like they're just Mull Drifters. Like, I don't think you should be designing sagas with that intent. And when you do, you should be deliberate about it with, like, I'm thinking of very specifically, like, History of Benalia. And that's, like, playing a very specific role as the Mull Drifter. Like, I don't know. I think that this set is, like, I think if you went back in time and told someone to, like, really think about what happens when someone casts the Eldest Reborn, and then what happens if you print a set of the Eldest Reborn 10 times, I think that's like a fairly large miss, and like also highlights the difference between doing that with War of the Spark and doing that here, where like you can attack their Eldest Reborn before it goes off. I don't know. That's just like my one complaint with the set.
Yeah, I think this batch of sagas suffer from the complaint that seems like it bedevils modern Magic as a whole, of like every card kind of does everything at the same time. And so it's easy for that to just mesh into this like soupy mess where nothing feels that distinct, whereas the original sagas back in the first Dominaria, it felt like they had this like locked in linear progression to them where different things were happening at each stage of that. So I think a home run from that set was the Mirari Conjecture, where it's okay, so I want to make sure that by the time chapter one goes off, I have this card type here, and then the same for chapter two, and then when I get to chapter three, all hell will break loose, I am going off, and this will be a big finish that the game is proceeding towards, versus a lot of the sagas, especially at lower mana costs or rarities in this year of releases, it just feels like, okay, well, I do a thing, and then I do another thing, and then a third thing, and it's hard to remember which order those things even come in sometimes, and like the read-ahead sagas mean that I can directly select the specific thing that I want at this time, and it's these are just like reskin planeswalkers, it feels like, without the inherent vulnerabilities of those. Whereas, yeah, I think sagas at their best embody that kind of flexibility and that Mull Drifteriness, if you like, but in a way that is kind of guiding you towards a more unique feeling conclusion.
Yeah, and it's not even just Fable, because like if it wasn't Fable, it would be like the Restoration of Aganjo. It's just whatever saga is the best does the same thing.
Yeah, it is the experience of playing against Restoration that different from playing versus Fable, and is either of those that different from playing against like Wedding Announcement, for example, or you know, there are so many cards kind of in that space, often competing at the same mana cost in the same deck. So I remember when we were testing these like Esper decks for the new Capenna Championship or the Grixis decks at Worlds, it's like, I don't know if you're meant to have a Fable here or a Kaido Shizuki there, or a, you know, the list goes on and on and on, and actually working out which of those were relevant in which timelines and like what mix of those you wanted and how to map that out in sideboarding, that was a fun puzzle for a very like hardcore competitive type of player. But if you're someone who is just engaging at more of a distance, then it's, or even just watching the tournaments, it just feels so samey. It's like, okay, I play this game piece and it creates three more game pieces, and then I just got my eyes are glazing over already over here.
Yeah, and I think that if we want to step away from Neon Dynasty, which again I really want to shout out, like every card in the set that is not a saga is kind of a masterpiece. Just like it lets you, like, it is, like, there's a lot of cards in the set that are powerful in a way that lets you dream big with them, but also, like, the Dragon Cycle, like, you know, Kura or whatever, like, just, like, that cycle is a really masterful, like, Farewell as a card, just really great. I don't know, I guess we should talk about the one other cycle that might be debatable, and that's the Legendary Lands.
Yeah, so I think these were, if you're doing a ranking of like cards of the year, I think collectively, I mean individually, three or four of them would make the list. Collectively, they are up there with Fable, I think, because, you know, Fable, we're seeing it show up in Modern, in Legacy, and so on, but it's definitely the kind of card which scales with the, you know, scales inversely with the size of a format, where it's completely dominant in Standard and then kind of tapers off a bit from there. The Legendary Lands are just transformative for Magic in the sense that basically any green deck without incredibly specific mana requirements in any constructed format needs a very good reason not to have a copy, at least one copy, of Briseidu in the deck, for example. And I think Besager is easily the best of them, and you can more easily justify excluding the Takanuma in whatever black deck you're playing, for example. But I think this is both the thing that makes these great and the thing that makes them very dangerous is that 5 years from now, unless we just go back to the same design concept over and over again, that will still be true. Like I can safely predict that in 5 years from now, in, you know, Pioneer 2 or whatever it is, like the best green deck in that format is going to have at least one copy of Besager in it, in a way that you really can't predict for any other card in any kind of normal release.
I think Besager is the specific one that's a problem because of how it hampers the two card types that it really goes at, or I guess three, but like the non-basic land things kind of like you could Field of Ruin or whatever. But the way that it specifically hampers artifacts and enchantments. That said, I think that if you are moving the game in a direction where you are putting more card types on your dual lands, and therefore can link things more into that, you may actually create a situation where these have a meaningful drawback. I don't know how good of an idea that is, but it has played out that way, at least from what I've seen in a lot of spots.
Yeah, and I think that was somewhat intentional given the schedule of set releases this year, where if you want to build some kind of deck with Triomes and Leyline Binding and stuff in Modern, then yeah, sometimes that Besager really does get in the way, and it doesn't feel free when it comes up and you know, you can't cast your Sarnoh Draco anymore, or your Leyline Binding costs a critical one extra mana. Besager in particular, yeah, if the blow up a non-basic land mode is devastating for the opponent, then they probably kind of had it coming, I think is the idea, right? Whereas, I think it could meaningfully hamper diversity if, you know, any deck based around an artifact or an enchantment, well, now the kind of immunity, in one sense, that those card types have is not really an automatic thing anymore in the way that, like, I remember at the very start of the year, you know, winning a PTQ with the Dreskai's Ascendancy combo deck in Pioneer. And, yeah, I mean, Besager was... but became a massive issue for that deck, among other things. But at the time, it was a case of, well, this deck is so good, in part because if you just resolve an Ascendancy in game one, it's sticking around. Very few decks actually have a way to meaningfully interact with it. And now it feels like even some, like, Gruul Vehicles deck or whatever that is paying no explicit respect to combo whatsoever, well, sometimes they're going to draw one of their copies of Besager, and now your combo deck just can't win the game anymore.
Yeah, I think that this may be a specific problem interaction between Modern and other formats, where... in Modern, a lot of the artifacts and enchantments that were played prior to Modern Horizons 2 were there because, like, they were the problem, like the Ensnaring Bridges and the Blood Moons of the world, and Besager is doing a lot of good work there to break them up, and presumably in Commander a similar thing is happening. But for, like, I think Pioneer specifically, the existence of Besager is, like, more likely to hamper good things happening than it is to solve problems.
Does that speak to just an inherent issue with those card types, do you think, where, like, for them to be good, they need to be hard to interact with, but then if one of them is too good, well, then it's too hard to interact with, and that creates its own problems down the line as well?
Yeah, I mean, that's been a problem for a long time. I don't have... I don't know. Let's send that one over to the Blogger Talk.
Yeah, it was a weird issue back in the day where if you look at, like, pre-modern, just the format or the time frame... so many of the absolutely busted cards in those old border sets are enchantments, right? Like, it's Sneak Attack, Survivor of the Fittest, Oath of Druids, Earthcraft. Like, the list goes on and on and on. And yeah, so if you were a black deck, you can't remove those things. And so luckily you have the tag team of Duress and especially Cabal Therapy, which allows you to at least, you know, keep up with that some amount of the time. But in terms of, like, actually answering those cards, the color pie was so drastically imbalanced when it came to that that was part of those cards' inherent strength. It's not just that what they're doing is fundamentally very powerful, it's that they're doing their thing in a way that is so much more difficult to interact with than, you know, I source a Plowshares, your Rafelos or something.
Yeah, that... I think that, you're describing something that popped up a few times throughout the history of Magic, and, you know, a lot of... if you listen to a lot of the limited boomers talk about Phyrexian Processor these days, you hear a lot of that happening. I really think it came to a head in Modern, where, like, Abrupt Decay was such a big deal, and, like, it really, I don't know, looking at the cards that exist now, it's kind of quaint to think about that.
Yeah, we think back to a time a decade ago where, like, oh no, my opponent is on the play and cast turn 2 Pyromancer Ascension, what the hell am I going to do? And now you can answer that question in any number of ways, which I think is I think on balance, it's a good thing. As someone who enjoys casting Pyromancer Centurion, it's a really bad thing. But maybe it's good that you have to at least work a little harder than just, you know, casting your spell and then doing whatever from there.
Yeah, I can agree with that. I think that wraps it up for Neon Dynasty, unless you got anything else, and we should be good to step into talking about Dominaria United.
Yeah, let's move on to, I guess, the back half of this year. So Dominaria United, and then the Brothers War, and then I don't know exactly how continuous these are with All Will Be One and March of Machines, not The Machines, or it's something like that. But we now have this return of this really long, year-spanning story arc, kind of reminiscent of when we had the Weatherlight Saga and the original Phyrexians and so on. What do we make of that in a world where, like, we're kind of moving away explicitly from those longer storylines, and then by the time we get to the back half of 2023, it's going to be, you know, here's the one Ixalan set again, and oh, here's Eldraine Part 2, Electric Boogaloo, and so on and so forth.
I think they're trying to go back to it to see how it does, because I think that we talked about a lot of the issues that happened of, like, what the heck is this set? And again, we're talking about they're going to two sets that are based on prior IP. It's not like something new and fresh. And Ixalan was two sets before, and Eldraine was, you know, basically turning a book into a series of books, effectively, you know, fairy tales into a set. Like, it's all in some way based off prior IP, and not like it is trying to feel out how you should be approaching making sets in the era where it is optional to have a block, as opposed to it felt like they were completely against having a block structure for the last couple of years, just because, like, that's what they were doing. And it felt like during the years where they were obligated to have blocks, you ended up with a lot of, oh gosh, what was the name of the second Theros set?
Oh, Born of the Gods.
Yeah, that one. You ended up with those. That's it. Oh, that one's bad. That one's real bad.
Yeah. I mean, Journey into Nyx wasn't lighting the world on fire either, but, you know, Theros itself was... that one was pretty good, as I recall. Anyway, we did also see that, like, Nicol Bolas macro arc, where we went to a bunch of different planes and sets and so on, but there was this through line throughout of it's the Gatewatch versus Nicol Bolas or what have you, and it felt like that did swallow up a lot of what was meant to be distinct about those sets a lot of the time.
That's fair to some extent, I think. I would say that I don't know. Kaladesh felt like its own thing, even if it was part of that. Yes. And Amonkhet is explicitly supposed to be the set that is about that. I don't know what other sets are really included in that arc. I guess Dominaria sort of was. That was kind of dicey.
Yeah, I guess Oath of the Gatewatch was the first step in that direction, and that block really needed something going for it, so maybe that was actually a blessing in disguise.
Well, that's a different story where, like, I want to know when we get Zendikar 4, just because I want to see if they actually have figured out what made Zendikar Zendikar, because they printed two really awesome Zendikar sets. Like, Rise was its own thing, technically, on Zendikar, and then they just haven't been able to do it again. It's really funny.
Yeah, I wonder how many tries it's going to take, and when they stop, just, you know, when they give up and move on to other things. But I guess we'll see when they announce the 2025 set releases or what have you. But let's take our first step in the Dominaria direction then with Dominaria United, which I think my conclusion is basically what I said before. Like, it's a good set, a pretty safe set, not pushing too many boundaries. But, you know, in a world where it felt like so many sets were coming out left and right, and all these formats going through these big upheavals, kind of nice to, you know, take it a little bit slower for a change.
Yeah, I really think that this... I think that when you are releasing four full new sets a year, you get to take a layup, and this was, like, a pretty, like, feel-good layup. Just, like, I think the thing this deck did right was basically just, like, it's set on Dominaria. It's a plane where you just get to, like, look at the set, and you're like, Merfolk players want something. Here's the Voldalian Hexcatcher. And then just, like, I don't know, print just, like, a bunch of cards that people like to see, and just, like, people will buy the packs for the cards they like to see, whether or not they are, like, dominant, broken cards. I think that this set did a really good job of that.
Yeah, and then Brothers War, I was very excited for the set, and in real time, I liked a lot of what I saw, and there's a bunch of cards which doing good work in various formats. I have a feeling, though, in 3 or 4 years, I'm going to really struggle to remember anything distinct about the set.
I don't actually think that's true. I think this feels like they released the second set of a 3-set block first. They've released a lot of the endgame cards for, like, a lot of synergies, in advance of what looked like to be two sets that are built around the lower level pieces that build those, like March of the Machine and Phyrexia All will be one. And I expect that, like, within 6 months, it'll just be, like, very obvious that certain cards from this set have been elevated by those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this set does have a lot of those, like, cogs in it, like, stuff like Mishra's Research Desk or Combat Courier or Scrapbook Mart. All of these, like, artifacts that just kind of tie the room together and let you do your thing. And then once that thing gets introduced, maybe in one of the upcoming Phyrexia sets, well, now you have the supporting cast there to hit the ground running.
Yeah, I think this is not a set that would be a good release unless it was followed by two other artifact-ish sets. But I think in that context, it's going to be the kind of thing that's allowed to grow. I'm actually like looking at the set just like in price order, and there's two cards back-to-back that I think are worth discussing in this context of like, there's Gwena, Eyes of Gaia, which is just like realistically like a fundamentally busted card that is printed in this set that like one day will just appear in a deck list. This is the two and a green creature that taps for mana and untaps whenever you play something big. Like, this card just makes mana and untaps. I don't really know what else to say about it. But then Skitterbeam Battalion, didn't this card win a challenge this last weekend? It's the 9-mana 4/4 Trample Haste that makes two more copies of it when you cast it. And then it also has a smaller prototype version for 5-mana.
So arguably the best deck in Standard at this point is a kind of Juju Bean Mogged mashup creation, I believe. As a, you know, two of the best grinders on Magic Online. It's essentially a blue-red Rambi artifact deck with, at a quick count, 25 out of the 75 cards in the deck are from Brothers War. This is very much a Brothers War theme deck with a bunch of other stuff sprinkled in, and you can see how even just one or two really good artifacts in the next set or the set after that could elevate that kind of strategy even further.
Yeah, and again, like these are cards like from this that we've talked about a decent amount. Like we've talked about the Might Stone and Weak Stone in other contexts. We've talked about Cityscape Leveler in this episode. Like there's a lot of cards with room to grow that are being printed next to cards that give them that room. There's also the fact that they put the Soldiers theme right after Dominaria United, which had a like secret Soldiers theme.
Yeah, I think you're seeing some more of that explicit, you know, plant the seed in set one and so the payoff is going to grow by set three, which you can do when every set is isolated by itself, but it feels more kind of explicit and jarring when it comes out that way.
Yeah, like I said, it is the piece that needs more context. Again, this may just be related to like exploring how block structures are supposed to work, because it used to be you printed a giant set that had all the primary synergies and then expanded on them in increments after. And in this case, you just have like three equally sized things and you just gotta figure out where things go.
Yeah, so thinking about specific cards that were the highlights of the year, hard not to talk about Fable in this context. That has to be at the top of the list. But instead of talking about Fable, because no one will shut up about Fable and for good reason, I think talking about why it took so long for people to catch on to Fable might be a more productive line of questioning, because I know that in testing for that Neon Dynasty Championship, there were one or two groups that even put Fable in their decks, and one of those said after the fact that, yeah, we didn't think the card was good, but then we ran into some Japanese player on the ladder and lost to them, and so, okay, well, maybe now we'll put it in our deck, which used to be how technology worked back in 2005 or whatever, so nice to see some of that still here in the present day. But it felt like this was, I think Palos referred to it as the biggest miss collectively that the community has had in years, and I'm wondering what the diagnosis is for that now.
You want to know what my diagnosis is? Because it's a completely different topic.
Okay.
This card came out in February of this year, and people just weren't playing formats besides Modern.
Sure, and even though it did catch on in Modern eventually, it took some time, and you know, it's not immediately obvious that it's going to be good in creativity, or like the scam deck was a glint in Pascal Maynard's eye at that point. So yeah, I mean, I guess that by itself does account for some amount of that, but even just that natural pipeline of, oh wow, this card was really impressive in Limited, maybe I should try it in Constructed, is the issue that like there's no competitive Limited, or it felt like there should be at least some route towards getting to that conclusion?
I think Limited and Constructed have really diverged in the population playing them. I don't think Fable was uniquely broken in Limited. Again, this has to reflect on the issues of Kamigawa Neon Dynasty Limited, where as much as I talk about how the sagas impacted Constructed and they're just like goobers of goobers, like that Limited format was just epitomized by just if you played a card that wasn't a Muldrifter, it was a mulligan. It was really bad. I took a step back from Limited for part of this year. I've come back a bit with the Brothers War, but like I used to draft a lot of the sets, and I burned myself out trying to play as much Neon Dynasty as possible, just like running into these 2-for-1 battles where, like, as the format progressed, you just like couldn't draft 20 2-for-1s. So it's just like if someone drew 4 2-for-1s and the other drew 1, the game was over. And then like into Streets of New Capenna. But like that was the start of it. And I think that Fable was just in this mash of like 8 million other cards that did the same thing. Like, it is the most powerful card in the set, but like if you look at like the next 5 cards, it's like, okay, well, Fable, and then it's like another Saga that is completely forgettable otherwise, and then like another 3-drop that produces other tokens, and then like Temeshi, and then another Saga, and then like another Saga. It just is more of the same.
Yeah, so if you could go back in time to a year ago and tell yourself during the preview season, and maybe tell me as well, let me in on the joke, why this card is going to be so good. Because I think in our Neon Dynasty set review, we didn't even flag it up, as I recall. So what would you say to explain, like, as the elevator pitch, why is this card going to be the best card in the set for Constructed across, you know, several different formats?
Well, I'm actually looking back because I tweeted about this card shortly after the set release, and I can pull up the record for now and actually look at what I said about it. because I think it was really the epitome of everything going on, which is just like, this is Season Pyromancer. And like, I didn't really play a lot of other formats at the time. Like, I was just playing Modern, right? And I didn't really care because there was Season Pyromancer, and I wasn't sure which Season Pyromancer was the better one. But like, you're just printing this card into 2 formats that have never seen a Season Pyromancer. It's like, you know, you've given the peasants Mountain Dew and Doritos in the 1200s, and their brains are exploding.
Yeah, I mean, maybe if you're printing this, like, reskinned Modern Horizons card in a standard legal set, that should be a warning sign that something is amiss here. And I think that is one thing that we are kind of seeing in Modern with the Scam deck, but I think there is more room to explore here, which is just decks playing both. I think that, you know, it's weird to say because some decks either can't play Pyromancer, like Creativity, or didn't really want to play Pyromancer before, but now that they can play Fable, playing, like, 7 to 8 combined with the 2 looks a lot more appealing. But I think that just starting a deck there and then, you know, like with 4 Fury, I think if you can, and then filling it out however you want, that is a pretty decent core by itself. And I think that there's more room to customize that.
Yeah, I mean, I've been playing with the Obosh deck this week, which I think has like 7 or 8 total of that effect. And I've actually been really impressed with like those 2 cards together. Like, one of the problems with Fable is that people look at the backside of it and are like, oh, this is scary. It's like, you need something scary to do with it. But like, copying Pyromancer, that is scary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so even after seeing it play out this way, I don't know what I would tell myself as to why this card is so good if I could go back in time. And that maybe speaks to the issue where, like, it is yet another of these cards which does a little bit of everything, but doesn't do it in such an overtly compelling way that you're like, I wonder how much anchoring bias is in play with just this says Reflection of Kiki-Jiki, but it doesn't have haste, and therefore it's a pale imitation of what the original Kiki-Jiki was, where if the Reflection had haste, the card would be even more unbelievably busted. Like, you could not print that, and you should not print that, and yet the fact that natural comparison suggests itself and isn't favorable to this card maybe made people think, well, okay, that's never actually going to come up in practice, and it feels too slow, even though the way the games actually play out, in part because of what the first few chapters do, like, Fable gets you to that point, and then the Reflection does actually do some decent work, unless it's removed.
That is a very fair assessment, especially when you look at the context of Bitter Reunion seeing Modern play in, like, part because it gives haste to Archon, but, like, also because it gives haste to Reflection.
Yeah, you get to build your own Kiki-Jiki, and that's part of the fun. So, yeah, I think that I don't know what the lessons are there for future card assessment, other than when a card is doing that much, like, it is going to be inherently a bit more than some of its parts. And also just put the cards in decks and play them. Like, I really regret that I let myself get talked out of even looking at this card during the testing for that tournament, because if we had found that, like, we could have potentially broken it. And instead, you know, we did fine, but like, we really felt like there was a big missed opportunity that led us to question our entire process.
Yeah, I mean, people have been doing that for 20 years, and they always say, oh, man, if I had only played with Eldrazi Temple and Thought-Knot Seer, or, like, if I had only played with Talarian Academy, like, you know, you're never going to solve that problem.
I mean, I did play with Eldrazi Temple, and my Eldrazi Temple deck was really bad, and I don't know how many months I would have had to spend in the bunker trying different Eldrazi Temple decks to get to, like, Ruination Guide and Vile Aggregate for that tournament. I don't think it ever would have happened.
Yeah, you probably would not have found that. That is
I would still be there now at this point, yeah. So beyond that, I guess we spoke about the Legendary Land. The Triomes, I guess, are the next place to go. But what even original thoughts are there to have about the Triomes at this stage that we didn't have back in 2020?
They exist.
Yeah, I mean, and they seem very inoffensive to me in a format like Pioneer. I think it's just another case of, like, you know, fetch lands implicating a whole band of accomplices along with them, maybe, in the other formats?
Yeah, I think it's also the kind of thing where, like, once you print five, the other five really don't matter. Like, it's not like the two-color land cycles, there's a lot more interactions of, like, how does A mesh with B and all this stuff. It's like, I don't know. It's just, you get so many colors off of them, it doesn't really matter. Like, I think this is, again, talking about the Elementals deck that I've been fiddling around with after it won the NRG. Like, there are two Triomes in that deck. They're literal Triomes. I don't really know, like they make colors. I don't really know why they're those Triomes. If you only had access to the fake Triomes, like, you would probably have the same similar kind of setup. It just, like, really doesn't matter once you can fetch two lands that produce three colors. It's just going to make all five.
Yeah, that is the cool thing about some of the pushed domain cards from Dominaria United, specifically Leyline Binding, which also would be on this list, where, like, you do actually have to think about which Triome you line up with this other Triome and which fetch lands and so on. But, yeah, I mean, it feels very samey, but maybe that's okay. Maybe that bit gets to feel samey because what that lets you do is, like, anything you want, and that's where the diversity is coming in.
Yeah, let's quickly touch on Leyline Binding, because I think that is a card that is done well on two levels, where, like, I think just printing a new removal spell that ties into your set's mechanics is kind of whatever. But I think that the fact that it is specifically a removal spell that you can interact with is pretty awesome. And I think that the fact that it really, like, you have put this into an existing mechanic of domain and extended, like, the previous cards with domain people played were largely aggressive cards, and just, like, creating a reactive reason to have domain is pretty awesome. We're not counting Collective Restraint, because, yeah, not really a magic card.
Yeah, I think also the fact that it's a cheap removal spell later in the game that lets you double spell, but without being just yet another thing that just kills whatever you want it to on turn one, I think leads to some really interesting kind of trade-offs and choices in sequencing. And this is what lets you kind of smuggle in a card with a more expensive sticker price without some, like, ludicrous discount via, you know, Delve or something like that.
Yeah. Again, this is also another case of, like, it is dangerous to play with cost reducers, except if it's a reactive card. This is how Rewind is an awesome card, and no other card with that mechanic should ever be printed again. Leyline Binding is very much the same thing. It's an affinity card, but, like, it's a removal spell, so it's cool.
Mm-hmm. The other card that I'd earmarked here was Ledger Shredder, which, again, I don't know how much it is to say. I think that this seemed like a good card at first and, like, massively overperformed even that level of hype. And then maybe it started to cool off a little bit to the point where, you know, I think we had an episode that was explicitly about these are the 10 different decks where you could put Ledger Shredder in, and that might single-handedly revitalize some of them. And most of those, like, did not single swim just based on Ledger Shredder. And for the decks where it did pop up, it was mostly this kind of, like, marginal upgrade. But if you woke up and it was gone tomorrow, it wouldn't be the end of the world.
Yeah, I think this card is really awesome. Like, it functions very similarly, yet differently in every format based on the scaling of the spells. I think that the biggest upside of Ledger Shredder is how good it is against decks that could be playing Ledger Shredder but don't. Just, like, based on the sizing and, like, how it, like, lets you play. And then also it's, like, very flexible in how you play it in, like, every single turn. And it does all that without directly interacting with any of your opponent's cards. Just really great design.
Yeah, I do like that the Murktide players are in this constant, like, revolving door of, okay, we knew we want 4 Ragavan, but beyond that, all bets are off. Do we want 4 Murktide? Do we want 4 Shredder? Do we want any Dragon Race channels. Do we want four? Do we want one or two? Like that, I like that that is up for debate in a way that none of those slots really were, you know, in late 2021 or something like that.
Yeah. I think this card's just a smash hit, really just outstanding. It tricks people into playing a lot of decks that are bad, but with four Ledger Shredders, which is, like, it keeps doing that to this yes. day, which is great.
Yeah, I think the there was the, like, Crabvine deck with Ledger Shredder and a bunch of Asmo stuff that either was in a Nonsense of the Week segment or ought to be in this one if it wasn't, because that deck was cool as hell. And, again, probably could make it work without Ledger Shredder, but it just ties the room together so neatly in a way that doesn't feel overpowering.
Yeah, it's the excuse, you know? It's not the reason, it's the excuse.
It's the gateway drug. Yeah. What were the cards that we thought might join that tier, but which fell flat for whatever reason? Are there cards which you felt like you or others are really overhyped in a big way this year?
It's just one mana artifacts for me this year. It was Inscribed Tablet and Luxior. I thought both of those cards were like very powerful in extending existing archetypes, and then those decks have just failed to show up. That was Luxior in the Devoted Druid combo decks, and then Inscribed Tablet and Tron. That one, the last Tablet and Tron just like not showing up is really shocking to me still, but it just isn't.
Yeah, I do still think there are ways to build Tron decks where maybe you're, like, I think the issue is if you're on either end of the spectrum where, like, you're Eldrazi Tron and you don't especially care about getting Tron, but it's kind of nice and you can do stuff otherwise, maybe at that point you decide Tablet isn't worth it, although it did show up in one of the recent lists there. And then at the other extreme, if you are actual factual classic green Tron and you need to hit Tron every game in order to do anything, well, having another like non-deterministic way to maybe dig towards Tron, like it's so marginal at that point that you just keep the core of the deck intact and go with what you have already. If you're somewhere in between, I remain confident that there is a Tron deck in that space, maybe, and say it with me here, blue Tron, which could have a greater interest in that card.
If my hands were closer to my headset, I would have removed it before you said that. No, I think the problem is that this card is just like the epitome of slow cantrips are worse than the London Mulligan.
Yes. And then Luxior, I think that I'm going to blame Devoted Druid for that and not Luxior. Like, it, Luxior is good at what it does, but what it does is just not really good enough.
That's fair. And if there's not a, like, if Renin 6 wasn't the Planeswalker to help hybridize it as a threat, like, nothing ever will be.
Yeah. Beyond that, I'm having trouble recording any, and I definitely don't want to say that I didn't have any missed calls like that this year. They're just not, maybe I've done such a good job of blanking them out that, you know, I'm in a state of blissful ignorance at this stage.
This is like those Twitter accounts that just tweet every possible prediction and it's just like delete all the ones that aren't true. So it's just like, the, like, they just list every team in the NFL is going to win the Super Bowl and they're like, look, I was right.
Yeah, I'm sure dedicated listeners of the show can let us know what we massively overhyped and then are conveniently trying to sweep under the rug in this episode.
Well, I do want to talk about one thing that you mentioned what was going on that we didn't mention Fable. Lurrus got banned. That was probably more important and probably bridges us to the next discussion about like individual formats where like the Fable thing dropped just as Modern was starting to experience the real shift it had this last year, which is the removal of the companions that were really warping things, finally.
Yeah, it took us all of 45 minutes, but we finally have more companion discourse once again.
I don't want to talk more about it. I just want to say that, like, in both cases, it is very interesting how much impact it had, despite the initial, like, you could cut the, like, in both cases, people just kind of like played the same decks and did okay. And it was only like 2 months later that we're actually seeing like, oh, we can talk about like X, Y, and Z being impacts of like, well, people aren't playing versus Yorian decks. And like, this is the issue there of like, they don't have this assured endgame. And now like, people aren't playing against these decks that are like, have this mid-range window where they're like, you can go over the top of their entire deck on turn six and win. Like, that isn't really a thing in Modern. And that's been an issue for like creativity. And, like, when Lurrus was banned, like, it took a while for people to start going down this road of, like, well, I can actually grind out Izzet with, like, I don't know, Grist and Young Wolf. And I think that that is a very interesting, like, it is interesting that the companions are both in your face, this is horrific, and also, like, subtly warping even at the points where they don't even look that horrific.
And honestly, this is one of the selling points of the Incarnation deck in Modern, is you get to be a really good Yorion deck, and that is a massive comparative advantage in a format where, like, the only format where you still get to play that companion still. But yeah, I think we did see just how integral even just the threat of Yorion was to those four-color decks being as successful as they were, and that shift towards, well, everyone will just play four-color Gahira, that didn't really materialize, and I think that's probably a good thing on balance. I think that's a deck which you still can play, but you're not feeling obliged to, and the fact that four-color Karuga is actually more popular now, I think is probably a good thing as well. But yeah, it's interesting.
Hold up. More popular now as in one person is playing it and not two?
Sure, although I think it has a small but vocal and dedicated following, which hopefully will grow in numbers over time. In light of Mark Rosewater's wading into the companion discourse himself, it is interesting that in a lot of the explanations about why they didn't, and then eventually did have to ban Lurrus and then Yorion, it was always about what they thought were specific contextual factors to those cards and the formats that they existed in at the time, and never really made any mention of issues inherent to companion as a mechanic. And now it feels like at least one part of the company, and maybe this is just one hand not really talking to the other, but Mark Rosewater is almost like tacking hard in the other direction now of, no, actually it's companions that are the problem, and yeah, maybe there were some developmental failures in there too, but this was inevitable to some degree.
Yes, maybe there were developmental failures, but maybe the failure was just the dev team not even thinking about removing them from the set in the first place. I don't know. You made the mechanic. You can't blame the mechanic. That's your thing too.
Yeah, I keep coming back to that Sam Black anecdote from when he went inside the room to work on MH2 and saw that companions were locked in and had to not even break the news, but like actively convince the people who had just designed these cards that, yeah, you did your job too well. People are going to put these cards in every single deck, and they would be fools not to, and you are fools yourself somehow for not doing this already.
Yeah, I'm good. I don't have to think about Lurrus and Yorion ever again, so I just won't. That's my plan.
You get to think about a Karuga now for the rest of time.
There is a GIF for that that I'm sure people may know of and look at, so that's fine.
Moving swiftly on then, so we could touch briefly on the tournaments of the year, and I think one issue with the state of organized play over the past, I think really the entire COVID era, is people just didn't care about the tournaments, and that extended to the people playing in the tournaments a lot of the time.
Well, I think you skipped over something with the tournaments, which is that Pioneer was like not a format until April 1st of this year. Basically, there was a 2-year span almost where Pioneer went from like really exciting format everyone wants to play, and then it just stopped. And then there was this welcome back to the Pro Tour, we're playing Pioneer announcement. And I'm looking at the price chart of Winota, which is really funny because it has a very distinct sharp edge at 2 points. but you have the exact date this happened.
Yeah, I remember I would check in when Cedric would let me write a column about Pioneer every few months, and I'd be saying, hey, guys, listen, this is a really cool format right now that you don't know what you're missing out on. I know that the only place you can play this is on Magic Online. And even then, like, sometimes the challenges don't fire. And when they do, it's probably just Claudio winning with 5-color Niv-Mizzet again. But if you give it a chance, I promise, you'll like what you see. And then, 4 or 5 months later, this is the most officially supported constructed format, like, bypassing Modern at that stage.
Yeah, that is a weird thing to talk about moving forward, but yeah, I think that the recovery of Pioneer has been a big story of this year. I do think that, like, people talk, there is a meme about freeing Walking Ballista, but I do think that the very strict and heavy hand towards decks that are along those lines of just like, the game is accidentally over and you had nothing you could do about it, I would not be surprised if more than any other balance decision on the table, that Greasefang and Lotus Field are two of the cards highest on the ban list discussion inside WotC. Just like trying to keep any semblance of what killed the format in early 2020 out of it. Even if I thought that playing against with Inverter was really interesting and fun, I think that just like people hated it, and they want nothing to do with that again moving forward.
Yeah, that's why I think that something from the Green Devotion deck, whether it's Khan or Nykthos or something, might be on that roster, even though, based on recent performances, it's no longer even in the discussion of should it be banned. It's just, I think it might be anyway, because grouping it in with some of those other like super linear decks, like if that is deemed to be this like categorically unpleasant gameplay experience that will drive players away in their droves, then it might be similar to the round of bans that took out Inverter and Breach and Blister and Kethis, even just for good measure. Let's lump that one in there too. I could almost see something like Khan being the Kethis of that round of announcements, just because like we really want to wipe that slate clean and keep this clear mission statement for the format there.
Yeah, it would have to be Karn. Karn does two things really obnoxiously. One, which is like it is the card that makes mono green a combo deck and not like just make a bunch of resilient threats deck. And then also, I think that if you're printing a bunch of artifact sets, it's the kind of card that yes. It's just really obnoxious. I'm not saying you should. I'm just saying that if there's any card that's going to get banned in this format, it's Karn.
Yeah, you look at the artifacts, and if they have an activated ability, they might just be unplayable. And if they don't, well, the Karn gets even better because it can just fetch them now. So, yeah, however you slice it, Karn is only in the ascendant there. But yeah, Pioneer's Recovery really is one of the big stories of the year, I think. And I don't know if they will use that as a template for, you know, we have Standard as the format for the second round of RCs. I would be very cautious about drawing the conclusion that, well, we did it with Pioneer, therefore we can try and do it with Standard too. I kind of think the Standard might just be dead and buried at this point, despite their best efforts, and as much as that pains me to say.
That's a whole nother topic, and I don't want to get into this as a discussion for this year, because it's a multi-year, like, long-term yes. everything problem. I think that, like, something else with... So, the tournament series, let's get back to that. So, I think there's a lot of weight pending on this Pro Tour coming up in Philly.
Mm.
I think that if the Pro Tour doesn't go well, I think that there's going to be a little bit of a bubble burst there of, like, the prize of winning a RTQ is paying for a plane ticket to a tournament where the prize is paying for another plane ticket. And people yeah. will be unhappy about that. There is some discourse about that right now. And I think that the quality of the Pro Tour is very much what is trying to carry that.
Yeah, I think that is the danger of this new system, which I think does have a lot to commend it in some ways. But the way it could just like collapse in on itself is you have this progression set up where you climb this rung and then you climb this next rung and this next rung. And if one of those rungs is effectively missing because that tournament itself either just feels like a stepping stone to the next thing, or it doesn't feel like a satisfying goal to reach in its own right, then what's the point? Why even go to that trouble in the first place? And the Pro Tour is, as you say, naturally everything is going to hinge on the Pro Tour because this is the goal that you're chasing, and why chase the goal if the people who have reached that goal from the inside are giving negative reports about it. And so I think that actually like the kind of the washed up pros, as they would refer to themselves from that previous generation, who find themselves going to the first or second Pro Tour of this year, their voices might have this outsized influence in the discussion, because for these people who were there for the Pro Tour as it was mythologized back in the day and who experienced the Pro Tour as it is now, if they say that it's not up to snuff and they can draw that comparison from their own experience, then I think a lot of people will listen to them and take that at face value.
Well, I think that the problem was that I think that realistically, I don't know if trying to recreate a Pro Tour as it existed in 2013, it should have been the goal of this system. And they're kind of like stuck halfway between this obligation of this is what people remember the Pro Tour as, the like 2013, 2017 era, like Pro Tour, where like there's all this inertia and like production and things around it, when in reality it was like I think that ideally they would have wanted a Pro Tour much more like, I don't know, 2001, and I think that the problem is that people just don't know what that was like, and I don't know, it's kind of a weird spot where like they should just offer, like, they want to offer tournaments that make people want to participate in the system versus tournaments that people just want to attend and play as like a per tournament basis. And I think that's where the gap in the current tournament set is, where like one of the great things about Grand Prix was that no matter your level of investment in the game, like, you could just play a Grand Prix. It was cool. And you had people from, like, 20 years ago who, like, participated in the system just like, I don't know, I'm just going to play the Grand Prix. It's, like, what, 5 hours away? Yeah, I'll be there. That just doesn't exist now, and I think that's a pretty big gap.
Yeah, if you want to play a large Magic tournament, where do you go to play that? I guess that some of the regional organizers have been, like, the stops on their own circuits could satisfy that itch to some extent. Like, the DreamHack event in Dallas, for example, right? It doesn't have the RC there, but it's a big event. It's run by DreamHack. There's a lot of cool stuff going on. So we'll show up and we'll play Magic there. Or, you know, for as much as they got off to a very rough start, the Legacy Master Series over in Europe, like, they're starting to figure that out. And those events, I think, are probably going to look pretty appealing over the long term. But I think that, yeah, that feeling of, okay, well, there's a GP coming to not even my hometown, but just like two states away from me, and it's somewhat drivable. Let's get five of us in a car and drive through the night, and we'll get there, like, and road trip to it. That, I think, that era of Magic, just that feeling isn't there anymore. And I don't know if you can or should try to bring it back, but I think its absence is being quite keenly felt at the moment.
Yeah, I guess this is a very U.S.-centric discussion because there was still the face-to-face tour in Canada. The LMS series in Europe has done a pretty good job with this. It's like, I don't know, if you're in the U.S., you're just like, okay, NRG, what states are those?
Yeah, I mean, I think the big difference there, though, is previously, you know, 10 years ago, if there was a GP Toronto, then people like you would be hopping up from the States, and, like, people would be flying in. Like, it would be a kind of convention that people would travel to and want to travel to, whereas the face events at the moment, I mean, they're fun. I go to them when they're local or when I can get there, but they're not the kind of thing that I would say, yeah, you gotta hop on a plane across the border to get to this because you're missing out if you don't.
That is fair. I'm not sure that is... I think that they were... It is likely that any plans for those silo events would have had to been made a year in advance. And given the price of travel this year, they were very lucky they did not plan on that. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately hankering for some aspects of the old system is effectively wanting, you know, Huey and the team working underneath him to recreate a system which existed in very different times after the gradual iteration over the course of a number of years, to the point where if he was designing the system from scratch in 2019, probably would look very different from how it looked with that accumulation over time. And so trying to want that to be recreated in the year 2022, like, that is just not going to happen. I think it's a non-starter from every direction there.
Yeah, I think the worst aspects of the current system are related to that. And that's fine because, like, I think it is best if you just view this as year zero of a new system and any expectations of the prior OP are just not attached to it. Mm-hmm. Aside from the fact that there's a tournament called Worlds.
Yeah, which hopefully, I mean, even that tournament will look very different in 2023, because that is going to be, I don't know the exact number, but some power of two that's over 100, I believe. And we're already seeing that being filled out by, you know, the regional championship winners and people who, like, top two the marks and so on. Like, there are a lot of avenues to get there. You know, Nathan Sawyer will be there, of course, a friend of the show, defending his title. But that tournament where, like, you will not know a lot of the people in it, and the tournament will be a lot bigger than it has been in years and years at this point, that is going to be a totally different vibe from the, like, very exclusive 24, 32 pro fields that we've had for the past few years.
Yeah, and I think that's what it should be, because there's no, like, talking about established pros in an era of, like, arena set champs that people maybe knew who won, what's the narrative? Like, what 32 players are you choosing that you've built a narrative for? Just, like, I don't know, get people, again, this is the aspect of getting people to play your events because they want to play your events, and that is a thing that you can hand out a decent number of and have a semi-exclusive world, and that is an attractive prize.
Mm-hmm. And then finally, shifting from that institutional focus to more of a personal focus, your relationship with the game as a whole, what has that been for you in 2022, and what do you want that to look like in 2023?
Oh my god. So the content side of things, I mean, that's been weird, right?
Yeah.
I have written for like 3.5 different sites after writing for a single site for a decade, which has been like, I don't know. It's been a lot of shifts from like writing for Star City, which was very different than writing for TCG Player, which is different than writing for the current TCG Player, Channel Fireball, eBay amalgam, in good ways. For like each of them, like it's not like there are like bad things I have to say about any of them. It's just like they are each a different job despite being the same thing. I think that again, it goes back to the same point I've been trying to make, is just like I would like to find tournaments I would like to play as opposed to just like playing Magic from home and in an environment where like the puzzle of the game and figuring out what is good and like tracking the formats is still very fun, and I'm still capable of doing it. But like, I don't know. It would also be nice if it was easier to find tournaments. That would be another thing, but that's a different story.
Yeah, I feel quite lucky in that regard that I have like a good local scene, both in terms of just weekly events, weekend events, and then also the kind of bigger occasional stuff like the Face Opens and so on. So I can scratch that itch for the most part if I want to. And then I still do enjoy playing a lot of the online stuff, and I've said before that I think the weekend challenges are the perfect like bite-sized unit of competition for me in a lot of ways. And so, yeah, if it's a time of year where I don't have as much going on, then I can double down on that and enjoy that. For the most part, though, like I feel like I have done a lot of things just like randomly this year in terms of tournament results, where like, oh, I spiked this tournament and then that qualifies me for this next thing, and then I just show up to that and oh, well, that leads me here. And it's felt very, there's no like predictability to where all of that went, and so there's been this weird imposter syndrome where, even though objectively I think if I look at the last year, like, oh yeah, I've done pretty well in tournaments, I can feel proud of that, I felt like my process has maybe got worse, if anything. And so that, like, does that maybe mean that actually if I have enough results over that time frame, maybe my process is working for me in ways that I'm not even conscious of? Or if I actually got my ass in gear and figured out a good workflow, like maybe the sky is the limit. I don't know. And that is I guess it's a good problem to have, but it's also a weird one to have to think about.
Well, I'll make two points to that. One, with the formats being non-rotating, your workflow for each individual event matters a lot less than your overall workflow over a long time. And I think that that's, again, epitome of, like, the first tournament you played in each of these sequences is something that you just wanted to sit down and play that tournament and not, like, play that tournament for the next one for the most part, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think this was a feature of, like, the SEG Open grind, and I imagine for the kind of GP Pro Tour grind too, where it felt like each tournament, in a way, was preparation for the next tournament of that scale, like the next GP in 4 or 5 weeks from now, because in the time in between, unless Magic is all that you're doing with your time, like you just don't have time to really focus in much more of an intentional way. And so just getting those reps in at that level of competition is kind of what counted for most in terms of preparing you for the next thing down the line.
Yeah, that was something that was not the greatest about the GP system. I remember looking at tournament or like calendars for a tournament, and there were like 4 Pro Tours a year, and you obviously wanted to go to those because the Pro Tour was great. And then you'd look at the GPs and there would be like 6 that you would be like, oh yeah, I need to go to like the Modern Grand Prix in you know, this city that I want to travel to. That's great. And then you'd be like, okay, well, I need to attend another 10 GPs. Which ones am I going to?
Yeah, and it's you got to the point where you felt really priced into going to a lot of tournaments, which on their own merits never really would have caught your eye. And that's just a function of a circuit system like that, but not one of the most healthy ones in the long term. And I think that a lot of people who did commit to that grind for a few years, like, I don't think would want to do that again now, even if that was an option that was on the table again.
Yeah, that is a complicated question that I don't have a great answer for. I think that the answer is I would not want to do the 2016 grind in 2022, but I would like to, if I was like given the 2016 grind in 2016 again, sure. But that's like obviously not how things work.
Yeah, we're all old and fatigued now, and you know, I don't know if we all have the stamina for that again in quite the same way. But in terms of more concrete stuff looking ahead, I mean, I have the Pro Tour invite deferred until May, so I have a lot of time to think about this process. And I want that to be a tournament that I want to spike. Like, I want that Pro Tour success or failure to mean something, for better or for worse, and I hope that it will. And hopefully the first Pro Tour in Philly in a few weeks will be a good kind of indication of that. But I guess, like, that is going to be the return of high-level limited Magic, and for as much as we are a weekly Constructed Magic podcast, I will be listening to a lot of weekly limited podcasts, I imagine, in the run-up to that, and trying to de-rust in that sense and actually develop some of those skills I've just never had to hone. And so I guess this is me publicly committing to playing a lot of limited and getting limited coaching and like doing everything I can to give myself the best chance at that portion of the tournament. And then I still need to find a good kind of process that works for Constructed, but I feel like that is, I can draw on past experience there in a way that, like, I don't want to be thrown at the deep end for limited this time around any more than I did the first time a few years ago.
I cannot wait for that event. I think that we have lived in a world of limited for 2 years that is very different than the limited that we played before, and I legitimately do not know which is correct. I think there were some inklings of this leading into it where, like, the world of limited we live in now is very educated around, like, trying to optimize your chances to have the true best decks in a format and understanding what your variables are for getting into the other, like, options for best deck, and like then really viewing anything worse is like not even like just like something went wrong if you're drafting like the fifth best archetype for the most part. And I think that a lot of teams approached Pro Tours to that degree with a lot of success in the past, but at the same time, my most successful on the Pro Tour, like, there was a stretch of tournaments on the Pro Tour where I had like something like a 70% win rate in limited or something absurd, where I just like, it's like, okay, you just need to have an encyclopedic knowledge of the format and just like know how to draft all the ins and outs, and like, who cares if you're drafting the best archetype because you can maneuver into X, Y, and Z for your seat. And I don't know if the game's changed or if it's arena or if like I was actually throwing away equity. Like, I just don't know, and I just want to see what happens.
Yeah, that is what reassures me that I'm not just being like lapped on the racetrack already, because even though there are people who I think could realistically call themselves limited experts who they play a ton of limited, they've not played a ton of limited under competitive PT level conditions where, like, yeah, you're playing in a pod with seven other people, at least five or six of whom are very good at limited in their own right, and like that is a whole different kettle of fish, to the point where I can maybe try and catch up with those people and it feels attainable, versus like I'm never going to get to the sheer volume of drafts just like on arena that they've had, but maybe I don't need to. Maybe that's okay.
I think you don't need, you just gotta put in volume for the tournament that you're showing up to. I think, I don't know, it's, we'll see. I have a lot of despite having played a lot of limited since the last limited Pro Tour, I think I've only become even more uncertain about like the actual truth of the format.
So maybe that's something we can pencil in for like March in this coming year, then. It's just a limited episode talking about fundamentals, preparation, and so on. Like, I think that would certainly would help me, and maybe would help some people in my position out there as well. In terms of content and so on, I feel like we've done good work in here. I think, you know, the feedback that we've got has been very good. I wish more people knew that we are still going and we didn't end with that like Ragavan episode that's the last thing on the Star City feed. Like, I get that a disturbing amount, and I wish there was some way to just let all those people in on the secret, but hopefully they will trickle in over time and enjoy catching up on the backlog here. And yeah, I mean, I have stuck around at SEG, but I feel like I'm in a Home Alone movie or something, where it's like I'm there and suddenly no one else is there and I don't know where they are and they don't know where I am, and it's just very kind of disorienting in that sense. But, you know, trucking along, putting stuff out there, I think it's good to have that kind of that rhythm and that regularity still. But I think that is one thing I want to work on for this upcoming year, is putting out there just more stuff that I want to write, which isn't constrained by, oh, this is the format of the next tournament, or this is the thing that gets the highest SEO or whatever. It's just, oh, hey, this is some obscure topic in an obscure format, but it's something that I want to write for the people who are as interested in as I am, like that more kind of bespoke stuff.
You describing that is very interesting, because it sounds like we had the opposite experience over the middle of this year, where we were both basically like the writer for a website beating the drum for like a specific style of like, you know, I was focusing very heavily on modern for TCG Player. You were doing a lot of the competitive beat for Star City. And my experience there was like, okay, well, you're going to write about like this deck It's very easy to SEO optimize that. Have a blast, write everything you want about it. And I was just like, okay, cool. I just get to write like 2,500 words about a deck that I've really enjoyed playing this week. And it's good because I'm playing a deck that wins. Like, that's the starting point. And, like, that was like very, very like new. And like, I enjoyed that a lot because working at Star City for 10 years, you were like, okay, well, you know, Todd had picked up that deck a week and a half ago, so I am behind the times and I have to find something new and like all this stuff. And like, that was, that sounds like you did not have that same, experience, which was, it's just interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely was conscious of that when we were all there and having to often fight over the same topics every week and so on. But I'm thinking, for what I mean right now, it's more of like, oh, here's like a cool archetype I want to put in my cube and explore there. Or, hey, there's this like cool pre-modern deck, which you, there's no reason you would have heard of this yet. Let's talk about this in some detail. And it's stuff which I'm not going to get paid to write, and they should not pay me to write it. I would think less of them as a business concern if they gave me money to write this, because no, like 10 people are going to read it, but those 10 people are my people, and so I want to give them what they're looking for.
Yeah, I get that. That is also why I ran a blog for a while, and then I may pick back up. I don't know. That's been on and off of like the topics have converged to the point where I'm just publishing the stuff that I want to talk about. And I don't know how much of that is like a forced shift in how I interact with the game over that time to like being able to condense my interaction to one format or like a format and a half versus like the, you know, 10 years of like, I don't know, they told you to play like Mirage, Oath of the Gatewatch, Standard, but also it's a GP, so good luck.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is one of the refreshing choices that you mostly get to make these days, is just play the stuff that you want to play. You know, like I've definitely had those weekends where I've just joined as many challenges as possible and flamed out of some of them quickly, as predictably you're going to do with some of them. And looking back, it's like, well, okay, I don't really enjoy this format. I picked a deck which I don't have much experience with and don't know if it's actually that good. And I'm not practiced, and I'm distracted by these other tournaments on top of everything else. And so, yeah, of course I was going to fail in this. And of course I was going to be frustrated by that. And I should be, because I could have avoided that. There was no reason this had to happen. This was the most avoidable mistake in the world. And so, yeah, I think that's going to be part of my focus now, is just like identify what I actually want to play and focus on being ready for that. And that's going to be better on both ends there, I think.
Yeah, that, again, this is again related to the making tournament, like playing tournaments that I want to play in thing and not playing in the ones that I don't really want to. And I think that that is, this is another symptom of it, is like playing in all those tournaments that you don't want to play just like forces you to experience more than just the tournament worth of magic of like stuff you don't really want to play.
I think the real goal for 2023, and if I can do this, I'll count the whole year as a success. I will get us some entrance music and some outro music. I that is my solemn pledge to you and to the listeners out there. And even though I kind of like the minimalist aesthetic of we're here and now we're talking and I'm not trying to hack your brain with some soothing elevator music or whatever, I basic professional standards say we should probably have some music. So I will get my ass on that in the new year.
It's really unfortunate that the cold intro gag is taken and we can't just like fully lean into that. We do need to have music to differentiate ourselves, unfortunately.
So yeah, this is one area where any user input or pointers or suggestions would actually be useful. So by all means, get in touch with us and point us in the right direction there. But on that note, I guess we can segue into our actual nonsense of the week here, which is our final nonsense of the entire calendar year. So let's make it count.
Yeah, well, so I wish we had thought enough to like make a nonsense of the year and go back and look through all the nonsenses, but I think a lot of those nonsenses have turned into just like senses and things that happened for the maybe like 30% of them. So I think we're just going to talk about nonsense formats with nonsense of the week. The first one is, let's just start with the Legacy one. You talked about how Legacy is a scam, and Legacy has officially become a full-on scam with this deck that I believe Twitter user Killaby referenced Bosch and role-playing Modern Rakdos scam and just like putting the cards into Legacy. And this is just initiative scam. It is the scam cards, Grief and Solitude and Undying Evil and Malakir Rebirth, and then just initiative cards.
Yeah, this is like when two people that you strongly dislike end up in a relationship and you think, well, I don't know if this is going to work, but at least the fallout is contained to the two of you and it's not going to percolate out elsewhere. And yeah, Scam is one of the... It certainly is one of the decks in Modern, perhaps one of the most toxic decks. And then Initiative is just this absolute nonsense taking over Legacy. And it's only fitting that someone at some point would put their chocolate in their peanut butter and bring us this abomination.
Yeah, I guess I skipped over the important part, which is like Touch the Spirit Realm has just seen play in the Initiative decks and is a flicker for the Scam half of the deck. So like you're just like Ephemerate, Touch the Spirit Realm, and like Ephemerate supercharging your way through the dungeon. And like, yeah, it's all horrible. But you have to look at it too now.
Yeah, I think the Touch of Spirit Realm stuff started as, kind of as it did with the Karuga decks in Modern, as, well, this is a removal spell that meets certain mana value requirements, and in this case it's, we want to be a Chalice of the Void deck, whether in the main deck or in the sideboard, and can't have too many one mana removal spells with that in mind, and so this is a nice way to kind of hedge around that. As it turns out, just kind of a good card in this strategy anyway. And so even in the list that don't have Chalice or don't have it in the main deck, you still see a few copies just to kind of make up the numbers there.
Yeah, it's interesting how like, well, you can't really play Chalice with the Scam half of the deck. I just want to put that out there.
Yes.
But yeah. Maybe this is more of like a Chalice Zero kind of Chalice?
I think it definitely could be. Yeah, and there are matchups where like that is, Chalice on Zero is one of the better hate cards you can have access to in its own right. So I hate to see it. I love to see it. I'm conflicted. I'm confused, but not actually surprised to see it. This felt weirdly inevitable in one sense.
Yeah. What about this other deck? Do you feel that this other deck is inevitable from Vintage? This deck top eighted one of the challenges this weekend and is maybe indicative of how Vintage is in a like absolutely inscrutable place. It features Fable of the Mirror Breaker, 2022 standout in Vintage. It also features, I think the reason I wanted to bring this up is not because it's Vintage, but because it is something that I feel like could be ported to other more reasonable formats, and that is just a fair Goblin Charbelcher deck. There are no lands in this deck. It's just got Seagate Restorations and Chatter Skull Smashings, and maybe that's a little harder when you can't just play Moxes and Lotuses to produce your mana, but I think you could get away with, like, this deck has Magus of the Moon and Fable and Belcher, and, like, that's a reasonable set of cards just to play, right?
Yeah, Charbelcher is like our Omnath or something, where if we untap with it, we win the game. But like, no kidding, we actually win the game, if that comparison makes sense.
Yeah, I would describe it, yes, it is equivalent to any other card that costs 4 in Modern in the sense of it provides an insurmountable advantage if the game continues with it in play.
Yeah, I don't know if either any Vintage deck or any Charbelcher deck could be described as fair or sensible, but this is kind of the closest thing in both directions, so props to it on that front.
Yeah, so I look forward to when we see the Moderner version of this deck in Nonsense of the Week in a week and a half, but I think this is a good starting point to start talking about this potential.
Yeah, and I think a great closing point to end the year on and end this episode on. So as always, you can find us on Twitter. I'm at Dom and Javier. He's at ARMLX, excuse me. You can find the podcast on Twitter at Dominario_pod. You can find us on Patreon at patreon.com/Dominario_judgment. And you can find us and other people over the holidays in the Discord. And we hope to see you all there and hope to see you all back here at some point in the new year. I will be off the grid for some part of January, hopefully not for too long, but the show must go on. Maybe we'll go on. We'll let you know when we do. But until then, take care, everyone.